Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. I'm today joined by Peter Findlay, research associate at the OIES, to discuss his paper, Canadian LNG Competitiveness, that was published by the OIES in December 2019. Peter is based in Calgary and is joining me by Zoom today, so I believe we'll be able to get a unique local perspective on the subject of Canadian gas and LNG. Peter, great to have you here. Welcome. Let's start off, you know, with your discussion paper, point of your paper. You know, your paper has a tagline, Beyond LNG Canada, will the country overcome self-inflicted regulatory uncertainty and a high projected capital cost to become a global player? Great tagline. So why don't we start the podcast by asking, why have you written this paper at this time?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, David. It's nice to be here. It's a very, very cold morning in Canada, so gas is indeed an important topic. I think the history of LNG project kind of frenzy and fleeing in Canada over the last 10, 15 years is an interesting one. Especially how it has evolved alongside the advent of U.S. shale and how that's grown up. Despite optimistic beginnings, Canadian LNG projects had largely faltered and shuttered over the past kind of 5 to 10 years. While we see in the U.S., Russia, and other global basins have delivered really quite prodigious volume additions. At the same time, on the other side of the ledger, it's quite impressive what the shale-led LNG Canada has done to be able to push through some formidable challenges to reach FID in 2018.
Yep.
Also bringing along four additional partners. And I think it's interesting to note those four partners are from four different Asian countries.
Yes, yes.
And this will eventually be, kind of guaranteed at 13 MTPA and likely up to 27 MTPA project.
Mm. That's big. That's a big project. But look, let's just kind of start at the beginning then of the whole West Coast Canadian energy export story. You know, what were the historical drivers that led to LNG Canada's FID? Is it really just simply a story of large volumes of stranded gas, or, as your paper says, a gas market glut? What was it that really drove it?
Well, yeah, I think that's the main story historically, and what's driven people here is the volume of the resource.
Yeah.
The Montney, Duvernay, and Spirit River basins alone, and that's not all the basins that people are looking at, is around 650 TCF, around 18 trillion cubic meters of gas resource.
Wow. Okay, that's big.
Yeah, and especially in the Montney, you've got some very wet gas and some very attractive well economics. So in many plays, you've got some of the most attractive well economics in North America in places, and much of that gas can actually be produced for effectively free or as a byproduct, potentially even negative, given the strong demand for condensate in the very nearby oil sands, because you've got 3 million barrels of oil being produced very closely, much of which requires light condensate to blend with the heavy bitumen production. So you kind of have this natural demand source there for the condensate, enabling the low price cost production of gas, especially from the Montney.
But of course, the gas is pretty remote, isn't it? It's on the other side of a mountain range, so it must be an expensive supply project, isn't it? Simply due to the remoteness of the upstream gas.
So certainly the full integrated project is more expensive because of that challenge, and you're looking at kind of 600 to 700 kilometers from the most attractive regions of the Montney, say. To the northwest coast of British Columbia, which is kind of the most logical place to ship it to Asia. And because of that scale, somewhat required. Right. It does take large projects. You need big pipelines. The capital costs for the pipelines are expensive.
Right.
It is very mountainous, treacherous terrain to get across that 600 to 700 kilometers. It's also remote to build a liquefaction plant in a relatively remote area of Kitimat and Prince Rupert, though there are industrial installations there. Historically, it's nothing like the brownfield installations of the U.S. Gulf Coast. Just going back to the previous question, if I could. In addition to the prodigious, on the advantages of Canadian LNG, in addition to the size of the resource, I think that they've also been attracted to the distance to Asia, which is competitive to other markets, except for maybe Australia, where it's about the same. And furthermore, it's the ability of companies to play in different parts of the value chain, so the business models that are available. Right. So I think that's relatively attractive to Asian buyers because they can play in the whole value chain and kind of protect themselves from commodity price swings.
Yeah. Okay. So the way it was structured gave the ability to invest in different parts of the chain, which of course is of interest to different players who specialize in that part. But Canadian gas, of course, is based on AECO pricing, isn't it? Now, how does that actually compare to US Henry Hub prices? Because they're pretty low at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, AECO prices is the Canadian pronunciation for those international folks out there.
Sorry, I'm a Brit.
AECO historically was actually quite close to Henry Hub. And if you look at the graph in my paper and other graphs from 19 to the beginning of 2015, it was between 80% to 100% of Henry Hub, roughly the same kind of regional and mostly geographic discounts that were relatively minor. But since that fundamental shift in lack of demand in the U.S. and the real burgeoning shale growth in the U.S., and also this play of condensate where we're getting more and more reason to produce cheap gas in Canada, you've got it trading much lower. And for much of the last year, it's kind of been at 30 to 40%. And there's a belief that it will recover to 60%, but there hasn't been any evidence that that's borne out yet.
Right.
So even a recovery to 60% is, I think, optimistic for Canadian producers.
Let's just come back to something, pick up something you said earlier on, and that was, you know, with the cost to the value chain, you need scale of production. So let's specifically talk about the cost of liquefaction plant. As, you know, as it's being constructed in such an environmentally sensitive location, you know, it must be more expensive to build there than compared to a U.S. Gulf liquefaction plant, isn't it? Doesn't that kind of destroy the economics?
Certainly. I think it's a bit of an extreme. It's certainly more expensive. I think it's hard to show that it's going to be cheaper than, you know, one of the world's largest brownfield installation of oil and gas operations around in the world. So there certainly is going to be a premium. The idea that it's going to just destroy the economics, I think at times that was the case, and proponents seem to be very careful looking at their technology, their ability to build in a remote location. But those that are more optimistic think that more and more can be done offshore. So moving towards an FLNG solution or potentially what's called more of a near shore solution.
Yeah.
You're requiring a little bit more advanced technologies kind of not in service today. And proponents do believe that's there and that the cost can come down. The other difference that I think proponents and investors and analysts need to look at is a lot of cost estimates are based on previous projects, previous overspends, and not necessarily in LNG. And what Canada is really kind of paying for is the overspend that happened in a lot of large scale oil sands projects in the earlier part of the last decade before the oil price rose. And since then, you've got a situation where the Canadian dollar has dropped probably 30%. So now about 75% against the U.S. dollar. And you've got more than probably 100,000 lost jobs in Alberta and British Columbia's oil and gas industry. So you've got a lot of people sitting in the sidelines at a lower currency cost. And this is what Shell did is they went back out, Shell and their partners for LNG Canada, they went back out and re-qualified some of their costs. And they were able to get a substantial decreases from their EPC partners. And so I think those two elements of potentially offshoring more of the solution, the engineering solutions, having it built in Korea, for example, and being shipped over, and more competitively going at a labor market that's kind of starved for work, there are opportunities to make the capital costs less of a penalty in that regard versus the U.S. Gulf Coast. But certainly it's hard to compete with the U.S. Gulf Coast.
Yeah, but to be clear, you're talking about offshoring in Korea, the modules for the onshore LNG Canada. And LNG Canada is an onshore solution. It's not a floating liquefaction solution, is it?
Yeah, and when I was talking about a fair bit of offshoring, I was talking about potentially new projects.
New projects.
Not as much LNG Canada.
Yeah, let's come to that later on in the podcast, if that's possible, Peter. The other part of the chain, so we've talked about the upstream, we've talked about the liquefaction, is the part, of course, that really has the commercial advantage of this project. And you've already referred to it in the answer to one of my earlier questions. And that, of course, is shipping. So do you have a kind of idea of the cost advantage of the shipping and how much of a credit this is to this particular value chain project rather than, say, the US Gulf projects?
Yeah, and we looked at a number of sources for this. So we looked at some of the SERI research the Canadian Institute does here. We looked at WoodMac. We looked at Sprott as well as a consultancy. And we did some work on our own with my Criterium group here. And it looks to be around a dollar per MMBTU from the difference between from Canada to Japan compared to the U.S. Gulf Coast to Japan. And not only is that dollar there, you also have less, you have more certainty in shipping from the northwest of British Columbia than you do from the U.S. Gulf Coast to the Panama Canal. And as well, there's less risk of things like hurricanes that could potentially disrupt shipment. With regards to Russia, probably they're a large competitor to Japan, or one of them anyways. The gap is bigger. And what we used for Russia was an assumption that half the year they would go the Suez route all the way to Asia, which is quite expensive and lengthy. And the other half they would use this North Sea route. And with that assumption, we see a gap of about $1.60 per MMBTU.
Let's add up all these elements together now and say and ask fundamentally the question, how competitive is Canadian LNG in the core markets of Asia? And how does it all add up, stack up versus, say, some other projects?
Yeah, and I cover this in my paper. And of course, being an LNG paper, we do have a price stack chart. Yep. Everyone wants to see those. And we do show it overall as being competitive. Mm-hmm. In fact, looking at more wet gas assets and being able to control capital costs, both of which LNG Canada is doing with Shell and its partners, you're seeing potentially a $1.50 type advantage over U.S. Gulf Coast for greenfield on greenfield.
Right.
Now, most U.S. Gulf Coast installations are brownfield, so the advantages last maybe 50 cents to a dollar.
Okay.
Now, so this doesn't get repeated everywhere. There's lots of assumptions on both ends of that equations, and there's lots of assumptions in every bar chart you see in a bar you see in a stack chart. So take that with some qualification, but there's more details in the paper on those.
And by the way, for the listeners of the podcast, I urge you read the paper. It's a fascinating story and also a wealth of information. But why don't we talk now about some of the issues actually on the development of the project itself? And one of the things when I read the paper I was surprised about was your comment, quote, Canada creates its own hurdles and risks to LNG development and also has onerous complexity of regulatory and indigenous relations. Can you perhaps tell our listeners about what is the story here?
Those familiar with global politics and those familiar with Canada as a country, just more generally, it's a very progressive country politically. Across many fronts, very similar to countries, potentially many of those in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. Federal and provincial governments and the public in general want to ensure all voices are heard.
Yep.
And that minority groups aren't trampled upon. So projects require extensive consultation with environmental, indigenous groups, really anyone who wants to have a say. Even those who live in the region, people who have land interests. Mm-hmm. And generally, this is considered good. This has led to Canadian oil and gas production being one of the most highly but most progressively regulated producing jurisdictions for oil and gas in the world, and a model that other governments have followed in the past. I know as the North Sea grew up from UK, they used some historical regulatory practices from Alberta, for example. Mm-hmm. So it is... highly regulated, but also is trustworthy, and I think most Canadians, whether they're in the energy producing industry or not, are proud of that fact. Now, the challenge comes for the Canadian oil and gas industry there will always be those who don't believe any projects involving fossil fuel should proceed.
Yeah,
a bit more ideological set, and that may be for environmental reasons. It may be they don't want anything near or touching Indigenous land. So even if that may be the case, even if an LNG plant, for example, makes a big reduction in global emissions.
Yeah.
So you have these voices have to be seen as well. And through how our court challenge system works and potentially even that could actually exacerbate the problem is this new Bill C-69, mm-hmm. is you get into a situation where the amount of political power that these groups have is disproportionate to their political support. Right. And it's kind of the special interest groups that have this veto ability of social license. And I quote in my paper, and I can actually talk. I can give the quote here if we have time, David. Well, let's put it back in my paper, in fact, and there's a little bit more detail around social license and some of the impacts it has on Canadian development.
Okay, brilliant. Well, look, I'd like to move on, if I can, to talk about the emissions, because you raised that in the answer to the previous question, because certainly Shell Canada has been very vocal about its emissions mitigation plans with respect to the project, and your paper says that the project's been at the vanguard to fight to reduce methane release. Now, can you perhaps share with us how that's been achieved?
Yeah, so I think globally, Shell, and as a result, LNG Canada, has a view of gas being part of the energy transition, and they've been proactive in trying to understand the methane problem, because if the methane problem is exacerbated, it obviously offsets the story of gas. And in Canada, so British Columbia and BC governments have been very proactive in trying to identify how much methane is being released. Mm-hmm. So they have, in many ways, more studies. There's a report from this institute and other reports that are out there. Methane release science is not perfect and not perfectly measured around the world, but all indications is that Canada looks to be one of the most proactive and looks to be one of the lowest releasing. Even environmental groups in Canada give estimates, obviously higher than the standard, but lower than much of what comes out of the U.S. So the combination of that, fighting methane and trying to measure it, and Shell's also trying to use hydroelectricity in the upstream to lower that further.
Yeah.
Combined with what they think is a more advanced low-emission plant, to shorter shipping distances, to freezing what's already colder LNG in Kitimat versus U.S. Gulf Coast or Australia or Qatar. Russia is quite cold as well, obviously. Yeah. But that combination across the value chain is they feel, one of the greenest LNGs in the world.
People actually often forget the efficiency benefits of liquefying in a colder climate. And I think it's a very valid you raise that. But, you know, the paper says that LNG Canada is required to meet a greenhouse gas intensity benchmark of 0.16 tonnes of CO2 equivalent per tonne of LNG produced. Can you perhaps share with us how this is calculated and more importantly, how will it be monitored?
So I don't have, and I've dug into it a little bit, and Shell hasn't released just from their public exactly how they are calculating it. What they are doing is they've benchmarked themselves closely against all other operating LNG plants. And what they see is kind of, say, the top five in the world are 0.22 to 0.25.
Right.
The average, they think, is about, of all LNG plants, about 0.32.
Right.
And so they've designed their whole facility and project, and the fact that it's up in Kitimat, to be about 50% better than that global average. But remember, David, that's just liquefaction.
We
always got to look at the entire value chain.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't include the upstream. And just one other thing before we move on from the environmental question, I just wanted to note something else you did say in your paper, is when actually in 2015 they were awarded the environmental assessment and export permit, it was caveated with about 54 conditions. So there's been a lot of monitoring, hasn't there, really, during the construction phase?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people see those numbers and they're always big. Like, you can't get a pipeline approved in Canada, it seems like, with less than at least 100. So Trans Mountain expansion, for example, was caveated with 157.
Okay.
There'll always be little checkboxes. If you could get a project of that magnitude approved for less than 50 or 30, I think that would be almost a miracle, because there's so many little checkboxes that the government makes sure that are done before.
No, I like that. That gives a sense of reality, Peter, which is great. Well, look, why don't we return to our discussion on the competitiveness of West Coast Canadian LNG? And I think that the fundamental question I'd like to ask you is, does Canada want to be a major LNG player? And if yes, what is the driver? Is it economic or is it environmental?
I think it needs to be a bit of a combination of both, given the political climate in Canada. You know, certain people are very climate change driven in their political sway. And it's a very, just telling about from the last election, most Canadians care deeply about climate change. Mm-hmm. And so if the environmental story is not there, it's unlikely that federal and provincial governments are going to act to help Canada be a major player. On the other side, you have that economic push. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think, one issue that those, you know, left and right-wing groups, or however you want to label them, could probably work together to make some significant ability to grow the economy specifically. For example, LNG Canada, is and will be the largest private investment in Canadian history of any project in any sphere.
That's amazing. That really is amazing when you look at it like that, isn't it?
Yeah. So people who are understanding both the economics and environmental benefits, I think it would be a no-brainer for them to, or at least if they believe that that the gas will offset the coal use in Asia, at that point it seems quite obvious that Canada should push to be an LNG player.
But you also say that, you know, Canada needs to increase its competitiveness. So what has to happen for Canada to do that?
So yeah, we go into this a little more deeply in our paper.
You do. I have to say, yes.
I'm not going to read them all out, but really it's a concerted effort, both from industry and government. And we talked quite a bit with people in industry. We talked with people who work on policy, for example, the GS3 consultants here in Alberta and Canada that work on energy policy for the government. And we came up with 10 points.
Right.
And a lot of them are help work on capital cost savings, work on articulating the Canadian LNG story to a wider audience. It's trying to make sure that Canada gets credit for and is incentivized to lower global emissions and that we're not too parochial in our thinking and saying it's worth us to lower our emissions by 10 million tons per year, for example, for an LNG plant if we were going to save 60 across the globe.
Yeah.
So really trying to understand in an emissions impact assessment, like a broad global, fully inclusive one, comprehensive one, what's the net of Canadian LNG? And I think the research I've done and working with different clients and governments is that it is a net reduction and it's positive. It offsets climate change to have Canadians produce LNG than some of the other jurisdictions.
Wait, well, what I must say, and you've quite rightly said, I'm glad you didn't go through the whole list, but I do urge our listeners to do that because what I found fascinating was, as you said, it's a combination of industry and government working together to achieve this. But in the last, you know, the last few minutes of our podcast, I just want to address a couple of things. First of all, can you just summarize maybe for us, you know, about the West Coast projects which are under consideration, maybe the East Coast, because it would just kind of give a flavor as to the kind of numbers and the volumes which are being considered at the moment.
Yeah, and this part of the podcast will probably go more quickly than if you're doing the equivalent with the American analyst. There are fewer and fewer projects. So Wood Fiber looks close as a smaller project, only 2.1 million tons per annum. They're looking close to FID, but again, this is not a world-scale project. The one world-scale project that's been in under development for a while, Chevron Woodside's Kitimat, is roughly 20 MTPA. Recently expanded their export license, but at the same time, Chevron's announced they're looking to sell off their portion, which is never
that's not going to help spot. It, is it? No.
And a couple other smaller projects like Cedar LNG, some that are that one, for example, the main proponent is an Indigenous First Nation, the Haisla First Nation. Some other projects out east, for example, Goldboro, 10 MTPA, Energy Saguenay off of Quebec at 10 MTPA, and Bearhead LNG at 4 MTPA. Kind of semi world scale, but more difficult for them because the market in Europe's not as big.
Yep.
They have kind of more ardent anti-fossil fuel activism out there and less understanding of the resource industry. Though that Goldboro, to their credit, has been able to secure a strong commitment from consumer Uniper in Germany because they like that kind of green LNG story Canada produces. In addition to those, I should mention one more. There's a group of producers in Alberta and in British Columbia that together produce quite a significant amount of gas, and they're starting to realize that their future's in jeopardy without more of a LNG exit valve from Western Canada. And they've combined to produce or to develop this nascent but relatively impressive project called Rockies LNG. And Rockies LNG is trying to learn from all the skeletons and kind of wrong turns of the past projects. So they're able to actually keep development costs quite low because some pipelines, for example, have been approved, one from TransCanada, one from Enbridge that, that never did go through. So they've been through a lot of the hair of the regulatory process.
So hopefully, they if they pick up from the learnings, they might actually be able to deliver. Well, look, I'd like to end up, if I can, because I always like to end up podcasts by looking forward. So my question really is, honestly, Peter, where's this all going to end up? You know, will LNG Canada start up on time and on budget? And will we see FIDs for more Canadian LNG exports? And when? What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think starting with LNG Canada, and I'm not specifically a capital projects expert to understand. I've been in that world a bit. I think Shell has done its homework. They had a long time to go through FID. Mm-hmm. They thought quite a bit about who their EPC partners are going to be, and they financially structured the contract such that the EPC partners are sharing some of that risk. Mm-hmm. So I do foresee not extensive delays or overspend on that. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that we've seen in the past in other jurisdictions like Australia or Canadian oil sands projects. Beyond that, and the economics, we do break out the economics for LNG Canada for just for the expansion alone, and mm-hmm. That alone is quite compelling. So it's likely that that expansion program goes through. That's another 13 MTPA. Now, beyond that is the question, and that in my paper, I've kind of got two scenarios. One is the status quo, where Canada doesn't get another world-scale LNG plant, in the next, before 2030 anyways. Mm-hmm. And the other one is a high growth case, where we do actually get 2 to 3 more plants. But that's going to take that kind of concerted effort from industry and government to get over these hurdles.
Well, listen, Peter, in the 20 over minutes or so we've been chatting, we can't cover the whole paper. I do urge people to read it. And I have to say, thank you very much for your time. And as always, I've enjoyed our conversation. Peter's paper, Canadian LNG Competitiveness, can be found on our website. That's www.oxidenergy.org, where you can find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. I really hope that you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. And thank you and goodbye to everyone.